I would like to introduce Dr. Barry Castor-Pierce. He is the Professor of Fisheries and Director of the Rhode Island Sea Grant at the University of Rhode Island. He has a PhD in Oceanography and an MSc in Zoology. As professor, his PhD students currently work on trophic ecology, life cycle assessments, and carrying capacity issues in aquaculture. He has held a wide range of marine science and science administration posts in 6 U.S. states and internationally with ICLARM. Castor-Pierce has more than 100 publications, including 15 edited books and monographs, and since 1999, he has been an international editor for aquaculture. It is a pleasure to invite my former colleague from ICLARM, a person who made his name for reservoir management during those 10 years in ICLARM, and it's a pleasure to invite you, Barry. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm honored and humbled to be here, especially in the presence of my good friend, Dr. Eknath. When he said he's retired and sort of relaxing in India, please realize that he runs now one of the most important research stations in Bhubaneswar in the world. So thank you very much, Eknath. Well, I'm delighted to be here. I spent 10 of the most glorious years of my life in this region, and I've learned what I should have learned from school. I learned in the school of hard knocks of working in aquaculture, living out on the cages in Seguling and Cherata in Indonesia, and then learning an absolutely wonderful amount from my colleagues in the Philippines and in Thailand during those years. So it's a delight to be here. First of all, what I'd like to do is give you an idea of I'm so thankful for the 11 panel members that have contributed to our presentation. And I look at our presentation as being sort of an evolutionary database sort of presentation, because one of the things that we've tried to do is sort of gather all of the information that we could possibly get, not only about sustainability and use of resources in aquaculture, but to compare it with our friends in agriculture and fisheries. And so the Bangkok Declaration sort of set this forward. You know, it set that the development of resource-efficient systems in aquaculture in the great issues of our time, you know, food, energy, water, waste, and even sort of, if we go further, you know, into the larger aquaculture production network, was going to be in the next, from 2000 to 2010, of course, was going to be one of the greatest challenges that we were going to face. So what we did is try to look backwards a bit on all of the resource systems. We looked at sort of production, but as you can see, the other areas. And we tried to forecast a bit. These are ideal leaders, the 11 people that are on this panel. And they have many years of experience, literally total experience of hundreds of years of experience about these issues. And so one of the things that we tried to do is take a database approach and try to, so when you go to the paper, you will see not only fisheries and aquaculture, but you'll see a whole range of agricultural systems and how they perform in terms of water use, energy use, etc. And how do we compare? And so you can well imagine that we would desire from you and from our panel members as we finish this manuscript to add to this database so that we can begin to look at how we're performing, and we can look clearly at sustainability indicators and then begin to meet maybe some of the concerns that we heard yesterday on, you know, how can we move forward with some targets in terms of sustainability. The other part that I wanted to mention is, of course, all of these factors are very interactive. Even though we piece them off individually to take a look at them, obviously food, water, energy, waste, production are all interactive. So that's where it becomes very interesting, when we can start looking at different systems and start looking at all of the resource use and then project out further. Okay, so one of the things that I wanted to start with is just this little ditty of sustainability. overused concept, absolutely. Whether it's overused and has many, many definitions, it has catalyzed a forum for the oversight and growth and development of aquaculture on a global scale. And so there's a lot of ways of looking at sustainability. You know, choose your particular definition, but it has created a discussion for us to, in this field of resource use, to measure how we're doing and what is decide for yourself what is sustainable. It's this little graph that I've got here. Is sustainability to this, I think, in this group, I'll pose this question, is that over time it's not black and white. It's not the bad old days on the time trajectory, and it's not global goodness or nirvana on the other side. It's all shades of gray in between. And what I think a lot of the sustainability indicators people are saying to us is choose an index of your choice and then begin to measure how you're doing over time. And of course, whatever indicator you decide to use, the amount of plastics, of non-recyclable plastics that are being used in aquaculture operation, as one very simplistic example, then what you can do is measure over time by charting that, how good you're doing. You're going to plateau, and then you can maybe do better, and you're going to plateau. And so that's the way we're looking at the development of this paper and trying to get sort of the database on what is going on. Okay, let's try to look at I will repeat some of what you've heard time and time again, but maybe we'll give a different twist on it. Although you've seen, of course, we have an Asia-Pacific aquaculture tiger, which accounts for most of the global aquaculture production. Please realize when we take outside China outside of that, aquaculture is still, in an evolutionary sense, quite a developing enterprise in every other country of the world. So when we sort of take China out of the equation, it's not 50% of global fish that we're getting from aquaculture. It's only 25%. So the rest of the world, there's still a lot of issues. We heard yesterday that production has been declining in Europe. Value may be still increasing, but production is declining. We're hearing in other countries like the United States, major declines in production and real concerns about space, land, water, user conflicts, to the point where we have to go, aquaculture may be a part of a large marine spatial planning effort. And again, for all of the global controversies over shrimp and salmon, still where we're at today, it's the evolution of the blue revolution. We're still evolving this. And most of production is freshwater fish, and most production is mollusks in the world today. Okay, so let's just take a look at production efficiencies versus a range. And I put this one up first for your consideration, you know, versus other comparable proteins that we see on the market today. And surprising, right at the top are omnivorous scavengers from the, you know, from the textbook descriptions of marine shrimp. They perform very well for all of the environmental controversies. If we just look at production efficiencies, the amount of edible protein we're getting, right at the top are two major omnivorous species and another low trophic level species. But versus other enterprises such as beef and lamb, you know, aquaculture is a very good decision when we look at it just from protein production efficiencies, or production efficiencies. These are not protein production efficiencies. Okay, so what I'm going to do is, and you'll get the manuscript, of course, and there's all of these tables that are going to come with, you know, a lot of data. And what I've tried to do is aggregate that data, so what I call sort of extreme use, and I'll define that, you know, high use, and comparable or low use for a lot of these resource systems. So I'm going to give you the highlights and then go into a few of the graphs. And my colleagues coming after Dr. Takan, Dr. Browdy, will, I think, reemphasize some of these points again, but in much greater detail, because ours is a broader stroke. Okay, so High water use in ponds comparable to terrestrial agricultural production systems. So pond systems, if we look at all of the other terrestrial agriculture systems that we could gather from the database, we on those three categories, extreme, high, and low water use, per its cubic meters per kg of production, it was in that second category, higher water use in ponds. Second of all, clearly, there is, in many countries, there's severe water competition, growing water competition with alternative uses. And last of all, what is very clear, a massive amount of damming in and impoundments appearing in all regions of the world, with hundreds of thousands, if not bordering on millions of hectares of open water surface land, water surfaces in impoundments, particularly in Asia, but also in Africa, small water bodies, and in Latin America, diverting water to coastal cities and to agriculture, with projected severe competition between ponds and other land-intensive aquaculture systems and agriculture and urbanization. Okay, so let's. I want to define a little bit more about how we looked at these and made these categorizations, particularly for water use. Again, we have these three categories: low, which is liters or cubic meters, if you like to take off the three zeros, per kg of produced product; high and extreme. So extreme water use, we said, was upwards of 10 cubic meters of water per kg of product. So down in the lower end, you can see that list there. I will not sort of repeat them, which is in the low water use. And obviously marine fish, we're talking about freshwater use. And in the high water use, from the data we could gather, you can well imagine some of the non-recirculating trout systems. And very, very surprisingly was to sort of see Pangasius catfish in ponds in Vietnam to sort of be at that extreme water use. Okay, let's look at some of the trends to 2050 that we saw. First of all, upstream's dams cutting off downstream users. You're seeing a lot of concern with the Nile right now and the future of the Nile compact between the upstream users in Ethiopia and the Sudan and the compact with Egypt that preserved that agreement for many, many years. That's a case in point. I think we're going to see much more of this in the future. Second of all is freshwater use conflicts, closing many pond areas and droughts in the production zones. Very rapid cage development in open waters throughout the world. A rapid decrease in costs and increase in efficiencies in recirculating systems, which obviously use water much more efficiently. Multiple uses of water in landscape scale systems of mixed reservoir production in the upland areas and downstream mixed agriculture and aquaculture. Very large changes in the traditional rice fish systems in Asia and replacement, particularly as we saw some of the more intensive nursery systems that were using rice fields as intermediary nurseries in many of the rice fish areas of Asia. Them being those rice fish nurseries being replaced by ponds, because farmers are earning sort of more income from the nursery systems, more productive nursery systems than the traditional rice fish nursery systems that were produced fingerlings for grow out in cage systems or running water systems, etc. Very rapid development of seawater farming, as we heard from Swaminathan, not only the seawater farming of aquatic crops, but also salicornia and some other seawater-tolerant terrestrial species. And then a real exciting development that there's always been a raging development, I think, in aquaculture and in many technological fields. Will technology save the planet? And reverse osmosis membranes, now getting to the point where with off-the-shelf 3.5 megawatt wind turbines being placed in the coastal zone, running low-cost reverse osmosis membranes and producing fresh waters from desal plants at a cost lower than we could have ever dreamed about, and moving that in some cases to large-scale urban areas. And that's accelerating seawater use. So this is the reverse osmosis. Many of my friends in this audience in the Mideast will know this deeply and are seeing this development throughout the desert areas of the world. And as you can see, this affordable desalinization collaboration, which is a collaboration of 10 nations, mainly private sector. And as you can see, the costs of per kilowatt hour, per cubic meter of desalinated seawater declining to the point where it's now technologically feasible to think about large-scale desal for urban potable water use and agriculture. So we're starting to see integrated schemes like this evolve. This is the three and a 3.5 kilowatt megawatt machines are, again, off the shelf, available for use in many areas of the world. Running this is the Ashkelon plant in Israel, which is producing at this very low energy use, producing about that amount of cubic meters per day. And one could well imagine, the rest of it is sort of theoretical, one could well imagine that most areas of the world are looking at where water is short of impounding that water in some way. And the rest of it is theoretical. However, please realize that people are already talking about developing these large-scale integrated farming systems with renewable energy. Now, that would be a game changer. If that's our projection out to 2050, that the capital costs would be secondary to the human needs. So let's just go on this a little bit more. The trend up to this point, Bangkok Declaration to 2010, is that a massive amount of increasing energy density in food production and the use of fed aquaculture in comparison to fishing and terrestrial agricultural protein production systems. So aquaculture is getting to a critical point with energy intensity in some of the highest production systems. Those of you who see shrimp aquaculture in the coastal zone, if you look just a little bit further, you'll see massive amounts of energy being poised along the roads, substations, various power plant development. This is a very energy intensive enterprise in comparison to a lot of the other enterprises that we reviewed. So what we've got here is again another listing with the three categories. This is low energy intensity. This is kilograms of fossil fuel energy. Kilocalories of fossil fuel per kilocalorie of protein from the product. In some cases, I've given you the two end members here. At the top are what we consider the low-energy fossil fuel consumption enterprises, primary production enterprises. Down at the bottom from the data we gathered are the extreme, very, very high. So you can sort of see where we compare with feedlots and feedlot beef, for example, and lobster captive fisheries. Just as one example and another way of looking at this, I mean, that was from sort of our gathering of all of the data, and we could put maybe the numbers all in an all comparable sense. There's other studies that have been done down at the bottom here, which address one constant concern about whether, in some jurisdictions of the world, whether intensive aquaculture is either going to be land-based or it's going to be water-based, and what is the energy use in these systems. And I've just put at the top some comparable, this is joules of energy per metric ton of protein from the top producers, agriculture producers there, and this other study that was done with salmon. And you can take a look at it versus net pen versus land based. What's interesting is that in the net pen system from the life cycle assessment, 90% of the energy was in feeds and 10% was in electricity, and almost it was completely the opposite for the land base. about 90% of the recirculating system's costs was in electricity, and about 10% of the energy density was in feeds. Okay, so in our manuscript, three findings: recirculating systems are still very energy intensive compared to other systems, and they have a very large carbon footprint. Where we could get the carbon footprint numbers, they're all included in the manuscript. I've not reviewed them here. Second of all is that increasing the tools to sort of communicate sustainability, there is an increasing number of very exciting new tools. Either they're sustainability indicators coming from the EU Consensus Project, they're coming from ICES, the International Council for the Exploration of the Sea. There's a brand new book on sustainability indicators coming from the World Bank. But our colleagues that are looking at not only ecological footprints, the amount of goods and services coming in to support aquaculture, but our colleagues in life cycle assessments are saying that it's a very, very important tool to look at all of what we've addressed in this manuscript. And in some cases, we agree, because we can tease out the energy numbers from those studies. The game changer is the one on the bottom. If we are going to see, to 2010 to 2050, a large-scale use of renewable energy, not just solar, but wind and wave and other renewable energy systems, and if the cost of these are going to come down significantly, like we've seen with reverse osmosis, very surprising, then this could be a game changer for intensive recirculating systems, because the major concern with them is their large carbon footprint and their large energy use. So that's one of the sort of areas that we'd like to sort of focus on. For one of our recommendations from the panel is looking more closely at the renewable energy systems and intensive recirculating systems, and to see if that could make a difference in terms of their economic potential. Now, my colleague Albert Taken is over there. I see his smiling face, and so he's going to get in to a lot of this. But let me just mention some of the materials that his group and others have produced. First of all, we're going Bangkok Declaration up to 2010, and you can see the concerns from 2000 to 2010. Major concerns in the first part about overuse, escalating feed costs, qualities, and then new concerns, of course, about what are we really doing here, the social equity and poverty concerns about fish meal and fish oil, and then concerns that arose about contamination. Here's Albert's projection, and as you can see, the prediction is that the globe may be using less fish meal and fish oil, and also with aquaculture still increasing in production, because of not only replacements, but because of a lot of other technological advances. Those of you in the audience are listening to the spreading aquaculture advancements about finding functional ingredients out of fish meal and fish oil and using those in high-quality feeds. The other major development in this last decade is that a lot of the formulated feeds are going to feed what we called herbivorous and omnivorous fish. And this is from the FAO study showing that approximately, well, if you take the three top species there, normally known in textbooks as herbivorous or omnivorous fish, these three species now are taking up most of the world's formulated feeds. So 42% about of the total production of world aqua feeds is going to feed carp in intensive systems rather than sort of the old Chinese models of polyculture as we've seen. Very quickly, here's some of the trends that we see to 2050. An increased use throughout Asia, particularly in China, of an intensification. Second of all, particularly in South Asia, for Andhra Pradesh and India, an increased use of the cakes and wastes. However, major concerns for that increased Katla Rohu aquaculture in deterioration of water quality. A very strong decreased use of meals and oils in intensive systems. a replacement. We have a table in there trying to capture everything we could find about use of bacterial meals, etc., not only agricultural meals and oils, but other yeasts and bacterial meals, particularly in China, in bioreactors, but major new concerns to 2050 about if aquaculture is going to be intensifying its use in agricultural meals and oils. Another discussion is arising about the future of the Amazon, or even places like Saskatchewan in Canada, a discussion by the soybean associations. What is the future of agriculture's intensive agriculture feeding aquaculture? And so another discussion, this cannot lead to another generation of deforestation in the Amazon to feed intensive cages throughout the world. We have to start a discussion with our agroecology friends, with agriculture, to sort of avoid some of the issues about potential climate change that could lead to, et cetera. And last of all is this cleansing and the use of biotechnology, as we're seeing cleansing of oils of their PCBs or contamination. Another interesting indicator has been the fish-in, fish-out ratio. The environmental groups were dinging aquaculture for the last 10 years about the overuse of marine proteins and the marine environment. And there has been a dramatic decrease in the last decade, as you can see, fish-in, fish-out ratios for many of the farm species. And as you can see down at the bottom, there is still net production aquaculture. Here's just I'm not going to repeat this. Eknat's already flagging me. But here's a table that we could present to you on sort of notable research and development issues published from the literature, including something, you know, Indonesia's sort of fabulous idea of using insect meals, palm oil products. You can read it yourself. As you can see, if this is our future, then less dependence on the marine environment is clear for intensive aquaculture. This was the major study done by FAO looking at 21 nations and issues in seed as another resource issue. You can see in the last 10 years, the FAO study summarized the major concerns. We've heard this time and time again. I'll not repeat them. But a lot of the hatchery capacity is still not in place to support the development of aquaculture. Up to 2050, a rapid expansion, quality assurance. Professor Soroglu's presented a really outstanding presentation about this. Regional hatchery infrastructure is taking place in many nations with large donor support. Space, as you can see, nonsensical, commonsensical. Ponds have high land use and compared to others. Rice fields are being converted, as I mentioned, to nursery systems in many countries. And there is an application of footprints. We heard Professor Swaminathan look at that. Here is from our colleagues in Wageningen who work in the Netherlands, who work intensely in Asia, one of the studies sort of looking at the amount of land per metric ton of production. A lot of this, as you can see, is commonsensical to those of you in the audience. Intensive systems are less land consumptive. When we start looking at the footprint analysis, though, and this is one of the studies that I have in the paper for you to take a look at, fishing versus farming, some of the acquisition or the appropriation of ecosystem goods and services that are being done, a complete assessment and comparing fishing versus farming, you can see that people are saying the appropriation of ecosystem goods and services, if we take not an aerial approach, but an ecological footprint approach, in some cases, the appropriation is much, much higher than even fishing. Space, trends to 2050, urbanization very clear, cage systems proliferating. As I mentioned, the game changer with intensive recirculating systems could be renewables. However, in many cases, they remain uneconomic to this point. There are much more widespread use of planning and integrated aquaculture. Okay, so getting to the conclusions, there is a strong movement towards cage systems for many different reasons. Oceans, lakes, and reservoirs in addition, open water systems. The use of renewable energy and recirculating systems could develop very, very rapidly. Multiple uses of reservoirs and agriculture and aquaculture integrations, particularly in desert regions, could evolve as evolved in Israel. It could evolve much more rapidly in other desert areas of the world. Much tighter. And last of all, a new sense of professionalism emerging where professionals in our field talking about sustainable seafood supplies. So a new level of professionalism where people are being trained not only in aquaculture, but also in sustainable fisheries. Because sustainable fisheries, all fisheries of the world are under immense pressure to become more sustainable. And so this new level of professionalism where people are looking at delivering to society, to those that they report to, sustainable seafood supplies for society. And that is going to come from both fisheries and aquaculture. So we need a new cadre of professionals who can work on sustainable fisheries and sustainable aquaculture, look at volume and market and price competition between them. You've seen a lot of these. I'm a fan of Venn diagrams. You're seeing one presented in front of you. I use this one a lot. It may be a little bit naive because it comes really from the Chinese model. But I feel very strongly that we go back and forth between these new and innovative systems and social ecosystems on a regular basis. One of the more surprising technological developments are these bycage culture systems, which are proliferating in areas in Indonesia, have also been tested very effectively in Europe, where a fed portion of an enclosed system is matched with an unfed, and two crops are obtained from the same water, from the same structure. This is not sort of a very theoretical at this point. This is commercial. It is one of, for example, fed carps and then tilapias on the outside is one of the more exciting new production models coming out of some areas of Asia, particularly in West Java in Indonesia. And then some of the systems that we've been developing in the last few years, we have a large project now in southern Mexico using these aquapods. These are 3,600 cubic meter grow-out systems, but then we're developing all of the different systems, mini-pods, nanopods, and they're low-cost. They offer the opportunity of a new generation of detrital as well as non-fed aquaculture systems. We can get into that later. Then the wind power areas of the world, a lot of opportunities here into the future for merging marine spatial planning for aquaculture in depth. And so here's some of the designs. They're coming from Germany. They're coming from the UK. They're coming from the US, proliferating and plans in Latin America right now. You can see submerged shellfish culture of many different kinds in a three-dimensional space hanging in the water column on the bottom in the lease areas off of the towers, not on the towers. Believe it or not, on some of these towers, you get upwards in the temperate zone, you get upwards of 3 meters of encrusting mussels on the sides of the towers. So even from the outset, a public-public partnership, a public-private partnership, or private, however you want to work out the business opportunity, these towers are threatened because of the encrusting organisms. And so there's new business opportunities rather than sort of going and just taking all of the mussels and putting them all on the ocean floor, harvesting the mussels off of them, going into some of the finest markets in the world today. And so you'll see a lot of this planning down at the bottom. You can see trestles for submerged shellfish aquaculture, other structures for seaweed aquaculture. Okay, so to end off on our three recommendations, probably the most exciting part of this is that we have now new indicators. that can clearly articulate where we're at on the sustainability trajectory, and we can communicate this back to decision makers who are interested in ecosystem approaches to aquaculture. Hopefully that will lead on to a whole new generation of market forces. I can tell you that this is a major driver in Europe and North America, is the whole concept of sustainable seafood and delivering those products. Sustainable sources of supply, as I mentioned, a new generation of transdisciplinary professionals who can speak both fisheries and aquaculture to ensure seafood supplies. And so I'll leave you with this little, another favorite thing that I do is these little Venn diagrams. It's sort of, as we look forward into the future, success is no longer just the seed feed in the need, which may have been up to the year 2000. If we look at the success of sustainability in aquaculture and the charting of resources, resource use in aquaculture, it's connected to these other enterprise systems around the feed, seed, and the need issues. And so there's absolutely a greater need for planning, more comprehensive planning, more transdisciplinary engagement in our field into the future. Thank you very much.
I would now like to invite some of the panel members who helped Barry in putting together that nice paper, and I hope most of them are here. May I invite Dr. Devin Bartley, Dr. Pedro Biano, please take a seat here, Dr. F. Greenhalf, Dr. Hassan, please, Devin, please come in, Dr. Hassan, Dr. Hernandez, Dr. D. Hernandez, Dr. Henshaw, Dr. J.K. Jana. Dr. J.K. Jana, please. My good friend, Dr. We just call him Sachi. Sachi Kaushik, please. Dr. Lemos. Dr. Krishan Rana. Dr. Rutar Sahar. I hope I got it right. And from AIT, Dr. Amar Yakupityage. So one of the most important aspects of this panel discussion is to permit the audience to comment on the reviews as well as bring into focus other relevant issues, making the dialogue more purposeful and effective. So the panel members are here, panel chair is here, and I hope we will get some good recommendations from this panel, and I request the panel chair, Dr. Barry Costa-Pierce, to please... You already have some recommendations already coming in. And may I now request any feedback, reflections, comments, criticisms from the audience, please? Oh, please state your name and your affiliation.
Tilapia is raised in ponds, isn't it? In China mostly. And Professor Sorglos this morning talked to us about bioflux being useful for feeding ponds. Other people talk about more equilibrated feeding in ponds to have the ponds generate their own feed for the fish to be more efficient. So I wonder, why do you need marine fish to feed tilapia if you can feed the pond to feed the fish?
Thank you. Tilapia, the fish meal use in tilapia is negligible, less than 5% in the farm. Some of the commercial manufacturers, yes, use some 10%. Yes, the bioflux technology is a sort of experimental stage. David Little is around here, about FCR is around one. And also green water, you can, in the pond, then you can get the FCR down to one or below one. In the problem is there's a lot of farmers who do the cage culture who are usually don't have big land area. Therefore, the cage culture farmers need the feed. Those feed contain about 5 to 10% fish meal. But in Thailand, these farmers get the FCR around 1.3 to 1.4 as a very so 1.5. Plus or minus 0.2. Thank you.
There is another issue about sort of extension engagement that has always been sort of confusing to me, is that it seems like the research portfolio is far ahead from the farming practices in some cases, whereas the research is clear that you do not need marine meals and oils for some of these species. Farmers continue to use them. Some of the researchers will talk about palatability factors, et cetera. However, if you look at sort of some of the latest published work, we know what some of those factors are, and we can provide sort of feeds for these omnivorous, herbivorous fish in more intensive systems that are totally based on non-marine sources of meals and oils. However, if you look at the practices, we still are quite far away from that. There is one other aspect that I wanted to mention, and I guess it was the impact of being in places like Nepal in the Pokhara Lakes, where we actually looked at some of these herbivorous fishes being non-fed cage culture systems. And so some of these systems were there in the Philippines, in Laguna Dubai, where you could get, in the eutrophic water bodies, you could get crops totally not fed at proper curing capacities or stocking densities with no feed whatsoever. And so that's another area that I think that we need to maybe circle back to and take a fresh look at, is this whole idea of bioflocks, no feed systems, and their economic feasibility for the future.
Devin?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. A lot of the farmers don't actually have access to the published research that Barry was talking about, and they don't only use marine fish. They use freshwater fish locally available to feed tilapia, and it's their impression that the tilapia grow faster. But a thing that I really liked about the presentation was getting aquaculturists to interact with fishery scientists, because, in fact, the use of these locally available fish is not sustainable. It not only degrades that fishery, but it also degrades the environment that the tilapia are growing in, which leads to fish kills even. So I think expanding aquaculture to include fishery scientists and looking at this big picture ecosystem approach will be really important for the next few decades.
Thank you. At this stage, I think I would like to recognize the presence of the World Food Prize laureate, Dr. Gupta, there. Sir, thank you very much for coming for this session, and we are happy you are with us. And now I would like to invite Dr. Peter Edwards to please give his reflections.
Thank you. Peter Edwards from the Asian Institute of Technology. In relation to feeding and green water in ponds rather than formulated pelleted feed, another way to feed the fish is what I've called indirect integration. I mean, one of the big issues in integrated farming is the on-farm resource base in the traditional integration is so low, there's so few resources that can go into the pond, either as fertilizers or feeds, that the production tends to be very low. And this is why there's been this almost complete shift to formulated pelleted feed. But there is an intermediate stage, which I've called indirect integration, which means integrating with the local resource base. And a very good one, and India is a leader in this in Andhra Pradesh. There are problems with pollution, gets too green the water, but integrating with feedlot livestock, which of course is a massive industry in many countries, and the feedlot livestock manure can be used as a pond fertilizer, and then the natural food in the water, which of course is high in protein and vitamins and minerals, can be supplemented then with local agricultural byproducts such as brands and oil cakes. And you can get up to 10 tons per hectare by doing this. So this is a local integration rather than importing feeds from cross continents. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Edwards. I would like to comment, or it was just a reflection? Yes, please. Two. One. First one and then the second one. Third one. Number three. Number four.
Mic on, please. I am from Union of Myanmar. My name is Kim Aung Soo. So I'm working with the Department of Fisheries, and it's thank you very much to hearing, starting from this morning, the presentations of the Dr. Segalus, and then a follow-up by the Dr. Percy. Actually, it's mentioned the reducing of the fishes, the importance of feed. It's mentioned about the feeding is go almost 60% of the production cost. We are finding in the developing country, like in my country, we find out means and way to reducing of these production costs, starting from the feeding. We are finding means by flocculations, green water systems, integrated with livestock, such as. However, by the meantime, relating to the trade barriers are several factors. Because in terms of quality control and the food safety factors, there are several limits in producing of this kind of fish, such as integrated with the animal. This is not accepted by other countries, and this is coming in a way of traceability, something like that. For this matter, so we like to appreciate, because this kind of feed substitution in several ways is good for the future and good for the advanced country and good for us for the future expecting. However, we should, by the moment, like the developing country, should depend upon the integrated farming systems and then fish in, fish out system. This is the thing I like to. This is my comment, and this is our position. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Yukin. May I request for comments and suggestions to be as short as possible and as crisp as possible? Number two, please. Here. You, sir.
Thank you very much. My name is Willard. I'm currently with the private sector in Indonesia. What I'd like to suggest is regarding the aquaculture sustainably and the resources utilization comparing to the agriculture, so like we've seen the comparison, the water utilization. So how about the some other like use of the fish meal replacement by the agriculture protein and so on? Have we also looked into the issue that so how much the resources utilization cost has been accounted if we compare to the agriculture protein use compared to the fish meal for the aquaculture phase? And also, like in terms of the sustainability issues for the aquaculture, have we looked into the the comparison with the agriculture, terrestrial agriculture production system, and also the livestock protection system, where we are standing right now for the aquaculture in terms of the sustainability? So using some of the indicators. Of course, we cannot compare apple to apple, though.
Yes, your point is, I think you got the point.
Yeah.
The question was about sustainability indicators and how it compares, where we are now as far as the utilization is concerned. And in agriculture, you are comparing with agriculture and aquaculture.
Right, agriculture and also the livestock.
And the livestock.
So where we stand right now.
Where we stand.
Okay. I just wanted to say the thing is, we're talking about resources. If we need about 28 million tons more of fish, and this is what the expectations, the calculations, we need to provide at least the same amount of feed into it. Let's not talk about feed, but there are nutrients which are going to be needed there. This is where the comparisons have to be in terms of how efficient we are in terms of nitrogen and phosphorus, just to take these two examples. And we'll be surprised to see that we are not all that efficient in the majority of systems. And that's one way of saying that we've got to be more efficient in terms of, and we can have debates on this, milk is more efficient or broiler is more efficient
than what his question was.
Yeah. Now, the second point is, again, we've already, I've been involved in, under the European research programs, been involved in what you call this fish meal, fish oil replacement, combined replacement of both fish meal and fish oil, in Atlantic salmon, rainbow trout, gilted sea bream, and Corp and so on. So we know pretty well we can reduce significantly the incorporation of these things. We also did what you said, a life cycle analysis of all these things. And there are indicators which are coming up in terms of life cycle analysis of, again, the feed is the major factor which is affecting all this life cycle analysis, be it carbon footprint or SO2 emission, methane emission, and so on. So there are indicators which are being used nowadays to compare poultry production, pig production, and other things with fish. It comes to the fact, finally, if you are more efficient in terms of simple terms such as feed conversion, and then they are definitely going towards better sustainability indicators.
Thank you. Thank you, Sachi. The gentleman over at the end.
Just,
and after that, Dr. Doris Soto.
Hi. Hello. Yogi Karelsfeld from World Fisheries Trust. I was wondering, there was several comments today that sustainability is one of the major factors that should be driving aquaculture in the future. Also mentioned that sustainability has many definitions, and it's being one of its prime uses possibly for aquaculture development is to create your social license for operation. Now, I think the social license from the West Coast, where that's been referred to several times, involves or includes the question of zero environmental impact. I don't see exactly how aquaculture at the industrial level that's being talked about could possibly be done with zero impact. So I think the suggestion is that maybe education can create, you know, that public license. But I think, you know, there's on the West Coast, there's certainly a problem with trust associated with, you know, business-driven in enterprises. So I was wondering, you know, how does one really deal with this issue? Do you decide that on the West Coast maybe agriculture does not happen? Are there places in the world where agriculture doesn't happen? Or does one build that trust in other fashions? No, what is really sustainability as far as the social license is concerned?
Thank you, sir.
You know, what's interesting to me is that your question is aquaculture inappropriate in some regions of the world? It's a very complex answer. Of course, you know, you have the politics and society and participatory democracy. So that's just one part of the answer. But there is another part of the answer which I think is very exciting. There are some places in the world where the ditty, all capture fisheries are dead. I feel sometimes that we do ourselves a tremendous disservice in aquaculture by sort of denigrating, in some cases, capture fisheries. Capture fisheries are still the major protein producer for not only the people, but the poorest of poor, and the middle classes of the world. Those who want to eat fish are still being sustained by capture fisheries. There's major questions whether aquaculture will ever fully replace capture fisheries. And so when I put my capture fisheries hat on, and I attend all of those conferences about restoring capture fisheries, there are places in the world, regions of the planet, where restored capture fisheries will produce whitefish, for example, that will present significant volume and price competition for aquaculture, for whitefish. And unless we begin to sort of realize that these are our friends and that we need to work together to ensure sustainable seafood supplies to the people of this planet, I think we will see continual conflicts like you see on the west coast of Canada right now, and there where people we must have another generation of professionals who can see very clearly through this dichotomy and another type of discipline.
Dr. Doris Soto, and after that Dr. Dana Sena De Silva, and then we have to stop.
Thank you very much to all the panelists.
You can lower the mic, please. No, somebody has to help.
Cannot go start.
Okay, that's better.
Thank you very much to all the panelists. I would like to ask you to comment on the real costing of the resources, because the feed has a cost, and of course the farmer takes care of that cost. It's a real economic cost. But how about the cost of the water? The real cost of water use is not always considered. And there was another resource that was not mentioned, or maybe I didn't pick it, and that is oxygen to degrade all the organic matter. It's an ecosystem service, and at some point it should have some cost, not only for aquaculture, for other users as well. But essentially we consider this service as free, but in reality it has a cost.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's just to make firstly an overall comment. I'd like to suggest that there's no such a thing as a zero impact activity. There's always some impact, and the question is to what extent is it acceptable? And I think that's a social dimension. The other big point I'd like to make is that we shouldn't mix science and the politics of science. There's a lot of politics and politicians here. We as scientists make various comments, but at the end of the day, it's the politics of science and the interaction of that in a society that's going to actually dictate to what extent an impact, if there is one, is going to be acceptable. So I'd like to make that point. The other thing I'd like to suggest that we move the discussion beyond the fishmeal debate. I think Barry mentioned very clearly that in terms of the low use of fishmeal, etc., we are seeing a very large use of non-fish material, both proteins and lipids and all the other nutrients that we are looking at. So if you look at that, the challenges that we are going to be facing in the next 4 or 5 years, if not more, is to how to secure those ingredients in the supply lines for the feeds, because we have established to what extent we can reduce fish meals. The bulk of our challenge is going to be in terms of securing those inputs is going to be coming from non-fish supplies. So we need to be looking at various issues that are associated with non-fish supplies of proteins and lipids.
Thank you, Christian. I think the question was...
Just a complementation, please. Still in the side of the feeds, we still have to, when you look for until next 20, 30, 40 years...
The question was on cost of resources. And also there is time. I mean, the generalities we can.
It's related to his commentary.
No, the Dr. Soto's comment was on the costing of resources. I think we need a response to that.
That's the most important point. Water is going to be, this was mentioned by Professor Sogulos this morning, water is going to be, and especially fresh water, is going to be the most important and most expensive commodity, or if you can call it a commodity. And, of course, water, since fish, aquatic animals, live in water, and the major supply of oxygen is from water extraction of oxygen. From there, it's a very difficult physiological process. It's expensive from energetic terms. So we have, for instance, in some cases, those who are using intensive systems have evaluated the cost of oxygen. You can also see that in the ponds when you have paddle wheels and things like that, they do have a cost. And these are generally, even then, this is where when you are getting more and more efficient in terms of use of this, how to supply the necessary oxygen, how to minimize water wastage and water evaporation in the ponds, for instance. And then you can still see that they can be reduced if you are efficient. This is where the efficiency comes in terms of how do you apply the techniques which can be. Yes, there are undoubtedly very expensive elements, and this is where we've got to be more water efficient, not only in terms of production of cereals, land products, as well as in the use of water for supplying the necessary oxygen and to eliminate the waste. Fish live in the same environment, especially in the pond systems.
Thank you, Dr. Kaushik. The last question from Dr. Sena De Silva, please.
Sena De Silva, Naka, just two comments. One is on sustainability. I think Yogi raised this issue. Very recently, Professor John Moore, I don't know, people with gray hairs will remember he was the lead author of the Club of Rome report, the first one, Limits to Growth, in the 1970s, which raised the issues of sustainability and resources. He just mentioned that sustainability is a matter of attitude. It will be very difficult to put criteria. But that is a side comment. My main comment is, I find in the region, like Barry said, Lapis Dua, the bycage culture in Indonesia, I find it very hard to understand why the rest of the countries, adjoining countries, don't take up such technologies. Very simple. Similarly, the other good example is catfish culture. Catfish culture developed in Vietnam only after the Vietnamese perfected the technique of artificial propagation. But that was a wheel reinvented. In Thailand, artificial propagation of catfish was achieved 15 years before, but it did not get to Vietnam. The Vietnamese reinvented the wheel, and of course there was a surge. So I would like to get your comments. What could be the factors sometimes does not get translated into adjoining areas and adjoining cultures? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Quick response, or I may have to give one because I'm sorry I cut you off. But please, kindly, take that last minute. No, you have come all the way to the stage. You were saying something about fish meat.
Yeah, no, I thought that I should have to ask to respond for the question. No,
sure,
it's,
sure.
It's only complimenting the colleague's question regarding next decades of using ingredients to produce feeds. So regarding the probably great reported disbalance between availability of nutrients as food and feed resource, where you could also prepare to use different feeds. I think this different feedstuff. I think fish meal and fish oil replacement is just the beginning of what we have to handle with. If we consider that lots of hunger is important in some regions where population is going to increase a lot. So we, in terms of formulated feeds, we should consider the use of more harder ingredients that should be benefit through processing or for better use of the nutrients in terms of the global balance of available nutrients for food and feed.
Thank you very much. Any last reflections from the panel chair, please, for about a minute?
Sena, that is an incredibly important aspect, the need for sort of greater extension and dissemination of innovations and success stories. So, you know, your book with Brian on success stories in Asian aquacultures is really sort of setting the stage for that. But at the same time, you know, how many people are going to pick up the book? I mean,
it's free.
We'll all line up then. Here's a real opportunity for sort of getting together maybe a regular sort of newsletters of innovations, you know, innovations in aquaculture or ways of, if you're going to get into, you're considering cage culture, well, then consider a basket of options. Don't just, from no feed through, you know, lapis dua, through, you know, an intensive and sort of, you know, match up the farming community or the development portfolio with a basket of options rather than just one. So thank you for your success stories book, by the way.
Thank you very much. No, it's free download, please. I recommend that book very much. On behalf of the organizers, I would like to thank the panel chair and the panel members for an excellent paper and an excellent presentation and for the responses from this one. And the audience has been quite interactive. Thank you very much.